My name is Catherine Gunn, and I used to work at GCHQ back in 2001 to 2003. And in 2002, I leaked a memo that was from the National Security Agency about surveilling the UN Security Council members about prior to the invasion of the Iraq War in order to get them to back a resolution that would authorize the invasion of Iraq. And so I did leak it, and then eventually I confessed to the leak, and I was arrested under suspicion of breaking the Official Secrets Act. And then they eventually dropped the charges against me after they charged me. So
Well, GCHQ is a peculiar institution, Catherine. I don't know. I keep seeing things like power outages around the world, and particularly in Spain, one of the regional governments actually stated this is a cyber attack. We've been cyber attacked. Is that the sort of thing that GCHQ might be involved in, or the NSA, the American equivalent?
I don't know, to be honest, but actually, the situation with our electrical grids around the world is a big issue because, with privatization, a lot of grid infrastructure isn't actually properly maintained. And also, the fact is that, and this is a whole other issue, but the fact that our magnetic field is weakening because the geomagnetic poles are moving. And so that decreases the field protection from cosmic and solar radiation and storms. And so those things can have an effect on our electrical infrastructure. So it could actually be something to do with that. But even in a recent talk by Catherine Austin Fitts with Tucker Carlson, she actually talks about the potential for the geo magnetic flip, or just the weakening of the geomagnetic field, which, if there was another Carrington type incident, like whenever I think that happened back in 1890 something. If we had a solar flare on the same level as the Carrington event with the current status of our magnetic field protection, it would probably knock out vast swathes of our modern electrical systems.
I mean,
So
isn't it possible for, I mean, I think it is, but I'd be interested to hear your point of view. Isn't it possible for one of these big information signals intelligence agencies to just get into computers that run electrical grids and say, right, we're going to switch that off?
I don't know. I'm not an engineer. I don't know whether they could do that at all. But obviously, there are ways that they can sabotage systems, probably. But I think the issue is also that, they want sometimes for us to be distracted from the bigger picture, and they want to make themselves look omnipresent and totally
Omnipotent.
sort of
Omnipotent.
omnipotent. Well, also everywhere at the same time. I mean, they're not God. They're certainly not God, but they seem to think that they can act like a
And
God.
I think the other thing is there's this post-truth agenda where the idea is you just can't trust anything anymore, and this kind of almost seeds paranoia.
I think that's deliberate. I think they definitely want people to flounder about in this kind of mud of not knowing what's what and not being able to pinpoint the truth. And eventually they might say, oh, well, AI says this, so it must be true. And I think they're beginning to work towards that direction by suggesting that, AI is foolproof when we know that it completely isn't. It's very, very problematic.
Dominic
But
Cummings, before Christmas, did a talk where he was hinting that AI already controls government policy.
no, it that's kind of crazy talk. It doesn't, I don't think, because it's basically it's a massive Wikipedia sort of ad infinitum. It's basically a massive information storage, and it combs through information in real time, and that's basically all it, the large language models, that's basically all it's doing. There isn't anything, it's not conscious. It can't dictate policy. It is told what to say. So if the government sets parameters within an AI system and says, this is the policy, this is the protocol, then yes, there is a possibility that we've seen it in healthcare where doctors and nurses will say, well, we're just following protocol. And where does that protocol come from? So if they put information into AI and say, this is how we want you to, we want you to create a protocol or whatever for this particular organization, then it could very well be dictated by what AI churns out. That's a possibility, yeah.
Yeah, with the protocols brought out during COVID, things like putting people in ventilators, preventing the use of ivermectin. I mean, this is you can weaponize protocols, and then you can say, well, if you go outside the protocol, you're not insured.
Precisely, yeah. It's a very dangerous precedent that was set. And anybody who tried to challenge it, as you say, they were hounded, you know. So I know people who basically you had their loved ones in hospital and they had to sneak them out of hospital because they knew the protocols in the hospitals were killing people at the time. And so even though their loved one was in hospital for something completely unrelated to COVID or anything else, respiratory or anything like that, they were frightened for their loved ones, and so they managed to get them out, and some people managed to get them out of care homes, but they were few and far between. And the ones that were left behind, I mean, it I believe it was a mass cull, and that deliberate culling of the weak and the vulnerable and the elderly in care homes and in the hospitals. That was the statistic that they used to gin up the fear for COVID. So they basically said, because, oh, look at all these tens of thousands of people who died with testing positive for COVID, and we know the whole testing thing is fraudulent. They needed that. They needed those figures to bolster the claims of COVID.
Okay, so who are they?
Well, I mean, this is going back to 2019 when the economic system was coming to a sort of grinding halt in terms of the financial system. And so there are those who argue that COVID was actually nothing related to a virus. And they clearly illustrate that this definitely had an economic motive behind it, because professors like Richard Werner, who established that, banks create money when they lend money out. So all commercial banks, all the high street banks, when they lend money, they're creating money out of thin air. He talked about the great financial crisis of 2007 and 8, and how, although many people, especially in the US, were hurt by that financial crisis, they lost their homes, they lost their businesses, for example. But the government pumped money into the banking sector in order to save the collapsing banking sector, because they had, been doing all kinds of crazy things, and, the subprime mortgage and all that. They pumped the US housing market up to such an extent that there were, there was a massive asset bubble, and people had borrowed many, many times their income in order to purchase a house that was beyond their physical means, and so on. And so
Well, I mean,
this
often
whole
people did hang on because often people purchased houses that they could pay for, and then there was this sort of period around about 2000 where lots of the jobs were then outsourced and outshipped abroad. Factories in the United States closed. And so people were calculating into the future, saying, yes, I can pay my mortgage. And then suddenly they realized they couldn't.
Yeah, well, there were very lots of different things feeding into this crisis at the same time, but the financial markets had been unleashed since the, well, probably the 1980s, but certainly it took off in the 1990s, especially with the development of, high tech sort of internet protocols, again, protocols for increasing their turnover and so on. And or algorithms, or I mean, I don't understand any of this technical stuff, but the fact is, they the financial sector made absolutely enormous profits in the 80s and the 90s, and but it was all kind of it was all basically gam it was a Ponzi scheme, it was a gambling system, in my estimation. It's just fantasy money, right? It's not productive, it's not actually benefiting the real economy. And this is the problem. As you say, the jobs got shipped out. The US, rather, the factories and the manufacturing and the industry got shipped out. And this also happened in the UK. And so the these countries turned themselves over to so-called service industry and finance industry. But that doesn't produce jobs, real jobs, and it doesn't produce real wealth in the high street, in your local communities, for your everyday, everyday person. And it reached a crisis point in 2007 and 8, so that that bubble burst, and the government stepped in to protect the banks. And then, but they didn't change much. And so the rot was still there, and it's carried on. And once again, when we came into 2019, the market was kind of doing crazy things. It was completely over-leveraged, and the repo market ground to a halt in early or in mid to around mid to late 2019. And they realized that they literally had to do something to prevent another much bigger collapse than the 2007, 2008 collapse. And this time, they basically, and this is what Richard Werner describes, the difference between what happened in 2007 and what happened in 2019. So they pumped money into the banking sector, the financial sector in 2019, in sorry, 20, 2007. But in 2019, it was a lot of big businesses, big corporations that were in trouble and that needed bailing out. And so basically, the BlackRock talked about the need to go direct in order to fix the si system. So what they meant by going direct was pumping money into the non-bank sector, trying to prop that up so that it wouldn't create a domino effect of bringing the whole edifice down. And so they used that as this opportunity to push through the COVID narrative in order to get people used to the idea of working from home, getting people used to the idea of doing business online, doing their studying online, and
Meeting online all the time.
meeting
I mean, of course,
online. Yeah,
that's all
all of
easy to put under surveillance. I mean, I my own experiences with our housing association, visiting them after the pandemic, is a completely different place. It's a massive two-story building, office building, and I've taken photographs inside there. It's like the Marie Celeste now.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, this is the trouble. This is, what's going on across most of the, well, NATO stan Western world, is that a lot of city centers, a lot of the offices are standing empty or underutilized. And the value of those business properties are collapsing as well, because, nobody really wants to work in an office, or fewer and fewer people like the idea of traveling, either in their own car or on public transport to get to
Well,
an
it's the
office.
cost in time and money in traveling to and from work. It's obvious people aren't going to like that. Anyway, you've done a, I think, a pretty good job of painting the picture. But I mean, I sent you this documentary to have a look at, Banking Nature, which is a French film from, I think it was 2012, which is explaining that there are massive changes, completely unfloat. I mean, it's a way, the banks are pretty naughty, really. Almost everything they do doesn't even get discussed or debated in Parliament, and there's certainly no public discussion. So, for example, the transition into using credit cards, that was never discussed. It was just that you get a sent one in the post. The transition from signing your name when you use it, that wasn't no one was asked about that. It was just done. Then moving from the whole sort of putting a PIN number in to just waving your credit card or your payment card next to something where you can't even see what the instruction on the screen says because your card is right in front of it. Everything seems to be being done with no public consultation whatsoever with the financial industry. And what this documentary is saying is there are big changes going on in the financial sector generally, where they're not so interested in money being used for paying for goods and services specifically, but also to, owning assets all around the world, that is to say, nature itself.
Right, and this whole, I mean, obviously the Malthusian idea of limited growth, and the fact that the earth can only sustain a certain number of people, and that the eugenicist idea has never gone away. It's just sort of morphed, and there are different terminologies for it. And the climate agenda, or the Agenda 2030, and actually, I think, I mean, I'm not an expert on this. I think Sandy Adams is definitely a UK based expert on the UN agendas. She's got a lot of the booklets, which are, well, not booklets, they're great big tomes, which are very hard to get a hold of these days. But I think Agenda 2021 referred to basically the 21st century. And so within that, there are stepping stones, and there's, the 2030 agenda plan, and the 2050 plan, and so on. And I believe that, we're not actually, we're not in time with their plan. So their plan has been delayed considerably. It's not going as quickly as they had intended. And so the things that they hoped they would have achieved by 2020 have still not yet been achieved. And they are being pushed heavily now to be achieved by 2030. And, you can tell it really has nothing whatsoever to do with real environmental issues, because one of the bodies, one of the organizations that was discussed in this documentary that you're talking about just now, the World Business Council for Sustainable Development, it actually partnered, it signed a memorandum of understanding with the World Economic Forum in August of 2019. So basically, the memorandum says that they would collectively mobilize action on urgent issues related to climate change, biodiversity, food systems, circular economy, including plastics, mobility, and other environment and social related sustainable development goals issues. And so, the World Economic Forum is this basically body of the top, 1,000 multinational organizations and financial institutions and, the heads of all the top broadcast and media organizations and so on. I mean, it's basically a who's who of the financial and economic, well, I don't like using the term elite, but the top dogs. And so all they cared about, all they care about is their profit margins, is the bottom line, right? I mean, we've got so many examples of how privatizing public utilities doesn't benefit the public. It has the opposite effect because, the private companies only care about making a profit and whatever their whitewashing or greenwashing says. So, saying that they're cooperating and mobilizing action on climate change and biodiversity and so on, as this documentary shows, all it's doing is commodifying the natural world. And what we find when things become commodified is that they actually it generates an enormous wealth for the people who are commodifying it. But in reality, what happens is it destroys that very thing itself. So, I mean, when you look at, just for example, when you look at your supermarket shelves and the fruit and vegetable section, what we actually, the choices that are there on the supermarket shelves are pathetic, really, compared to what, the plethora of fruit and vegetable, the various different types of apples, for example, and peppers, and all everything has every fruit and vegetable has multiple different types. And yet when we go to the supermarket, all we can find is two or three examples, if we're lucky, of that thing, I mean, I think is it Kent or somewhere in England used to be the apple orchard of England, and it was famed, and there would be massive orchards of, I think they had literally had dozens and dozens, maybe even into the hundreds of varieties of apple. But because of the commodification process of farm produce of groceries and so on, everything is commodified.
Well,
All
yeah,
we
but I
get.
mean, a lot of people will say, hang on, it's nice because I can go and get some nice fresh apples in the spring because they're brought from all over the world.
Well, yeah, and again, how is that environmentally friendly? If you're, I mean, there's often time, the UK, as I said, the UK had a gorgeous, I believe, heritage of apple orchards. We have plums. We have, any number of fruits that are indigenous to our to the UK, and yet we still get apples in from New Zealand, for example, all the way from New Zealand when we grow our own apples. And yet those orchards were probably cleared off in order to build housing estates on them or something.
Yeah.
So the commodification of nature, as the documentary was basically explaining, will have the effect of destroying it, basically.
They make the point that, say, doing something like going for a kind of nice walk up in a beautiful area. Does enormous things for your soul, but it doesn't cost anything. So the idea is, look, maybe we should just be corralling people so that they can't do that, and then if they want to do it, they can, but they have to pay.
Yeah, I mean that's exactly it. The process of the whole processes of life and relationships don't have a value, shouldn't have a economic value, shouldn't have a monetary value attached to them. I mean, I think it was in the documentary possibly where this guy was saying, for example, if, I said, somebody asked me how much I love my wife, and I said, oh, I love her this much that, I would only exchange her for $50,000, and obviously nobody would accept that as love. And it would be no better if you then said, oh, my dear, I'm really sorry. I didn't mean 50,000. I meant 500,000. I mean, that wouldn't make it any better. So the fact that actually the Agenda 2030 goals are also in line with all of this, because what they're trying to do is to get people off the land. Again, this is another depriving people of the common land, which is a whole process that started in the UK, 200, 300 years ago. It had the effect of plunging people into destitution because they could no longer, work on the land. They could no longer grow their own things,
Well, yeah, but
and
they could go to work in a factory in a city and then buy their food from the farmers. So it was just a different way of doing things. I mean, isn't it something similar been going on over the last 20 years or so, 30 years in China?
well, the trouble is the people that, there were people who lived, they were craftsmen, they were, carpenters, or they were any number of things, farriers, what have you, metal workers that, they were doing it in those days. And at the same time, they had a small sort of plot of land where they could keep some chickens, keep a goat or something, a sheep and a cow maybe, and then they would be able to subsist on the fruit and veg that they were able to grow, and the milk and the eggs that they were getting from the animals and so on. So,
And they're doing that without paying for it, aren't they? There's no money changing hands.
precisely, precisely. And this is, this is what happened when they prevented people access to the land. And I mean, recently I've been going through Karl Polanyi's book, The Great Transformation, and he was talking about the time. I mean, he goes right back to the land reformation and the enclosures in the UK, but and brings it right up into the ni 1900s, into 1940. And he talks about the fact that what actually happened when people were deprived of the land, and how demoralized people were, how completely destitute the vast majority, all the common folk were.
Yeah, and I think
And
it's true to say in China, there's a similar thing going on now where people are saying, well, actually, our life in the city is getting worse. We'd rather go back to the countryside, but now we can't afford to. How would you sum up this change that's talked about in Banking Nature? What is actually really going on?
well, I mean, it's just this process whereby, as I was saying about the Great Transformation, is that sometime in the UK in the 1800s, this new economic model was established whereby the market was everything. So it's this sort of concept of the market will look after everything, and the market is in no way connected to the environment it's in, or the social structure, the religion, the sort of community, and it's not connected to any of that. It's a separate entity in and of itself alone. And the pursuit of this sort of free market enterprise, what it does is it basically it inevitably becomes fascistic, because eventually, everyone has a price. Anything can be bought and sold, and people become sort of just shells of themselves. And there are no bonds anymore between people. So, in the UK, what they did at the time, unlike in other countries in Europe, which is why there was a much more apparently there was a more kind of massive upheaval in Europe. But in the UK, what the parliamentarians did was they could see this huge mass of people who'd suddenly been deprived of a way of feeding themselves. And so they brought in something called the poor laws. And so they were literally giving people money to do nothing. And that had the effect of making people completely and utterly demoralized. So it was sort of a catch-22, but it kind of, Karl Polanyi argues that this is what prevented a massive civil uprising and a massive sort of revolution in the UK, is because the poor were kept just so, carefully controlled with a little sufficient amount of money to keep them ticking over. And in order to push through the agendas 2030, they're talking about, universal basic income and so on. Because they know that the way they intend for AI to work and for digitization to work and robotics to work is that 40 or more percent of the population will not be employable on their terms. And so what will they do with all the people who are not employable? And so, of course,
Pay
all the
them off.
bleeding heart, well, the bleeding heart liberals say, well, we need a universal basic income. But then if that's attached to things like, a digital wallet and a digital ID, which is essentially what they want. So basically, this commodification process just keeps going on and on and on. And when they've privatized and commodified nature, what else will they privatize and commodify? Who knows? They're running out of options here. Are they going to commodify the moon and privatize it? I mean, what exactly is the end of this? The fact is, it's anti-human. It's so society, basically. And they know it is. And so they're devising ways in order to keep people divided and distracted so they don't focus on these issues. And they're devising ways to kill off people who are basically, according to them, useless eaters. And a drain on the public purse. And so everything is being manipulated in this way for these end goals of controlling people in these little human settlements where they won't be able to rebel, where they won't revolt, and they will have the play of the land. They will have it all.
Well, it sounds like this sort of own nothing and be happy world.
Well, yeah, and to go back to, basically this article by Ian Davis called The Not So Great Carbon Reset, he actually quotes from a meeting that was held by all the G7 central bankers at Jackson Hole, Wyoming in August of 2019. And August of 2019 is also the month that the WEF signed a memorandum of understanding with that WBCS, Sustainable Development, the world, whatever that organization that was mentioned in the documentary. And so everything basically was being set up in August 2019 for the takeover. And what BlackRock said at this meeting at Jackson Hole, Wyoming, they use this term going direct and they explain it. They said going direct means the central bank finding ways to get central bank money directly in the hands of public and private sector spenders. Going direct works by enforcing policy coordination so that the fiscal expansion does not lead to an offsetting increase in interest rates. So what basically central bank money doesn't have a way of going into non-bank sectors. And so they use the co pseudo pandemic, the COVID pandemic, to get private money into public hands. And He goes on to explain that this is a global coup d'etat. The government you elect no longer controls how it spends your taxed income. Central banks do, and they will do as directed by private money. That's what he says. And he says that, the global public-private partnership, and the public-private partnership, as described during the Blairite years, was the third way, wasn't it? And basically, it's a network of corporations, privately funded think tanks, intergovernmental organizations, financial institutions, non-governmental organizations, for that philanthropic foundations, and governments, academic institutions, civil society groups, media organizations, private investors, and so on. I mean, it's all of those things. He says it's hierarchical, compartmentalized, and an authoritarian structure. And I think this is what happened in 2019. Well, at the end of 2019, when they started this COVID nonsense, and it's carried on in different guises. And as I video I listened to recently, a talk that Alon Mizrahi gave last week, and he says what's going on in Gaza is beyond the realm of politics. And I think this is basically what's happened, is that we're no longer in the realm of politics because of this coup d'etat. The central bankers are in control and they're dictating policy. And so I don't know what your chap that you were talking about, Steve, if
Oh,
that's the same.
Steve Hall. Yeah, I mean,
Yeah,
yeah,
is that the same
he's saying
conclusion?
similar things in that. What he's saying that one of the first things that governments need to do is to renationalize much of the national infrastructure, which I think most people would agree with. In fact, quite a lot of Tory voters agree with it, amazingly, even though they might have a
Yeah, if they
picture of
weren't
Margaret
so
Thatcher on the wall.
distracted. Right. I mean, because the thing is, in this, as Ian goes on to Ian goes on to describe in his article, he says, in this fluid model of global governance, global think tanks coordinate and develop policy agendas in partnership with central banks, the Bank for International Settlements, and other key stakeholders, intergovernmental organizations, and global financial institutions. Then promote the agenda before national government, and these are the enforcement partners, convert it into hard policy and often legislation. Policy propagandists, such as the mainstream media and hybrid warfare specialists, which includes people like GCHQ, then sell the policy on to the public. We are then subjected to the policies that originated at the top global public-private partnership level. We've really they countries that have been fighting for years to keep their utilities under public control and all of this sort of thing are always fighting an uphill battle. And this is precisely, I mean, the UK has just gone down and down and down. And what they're trying to do now, I think, so if we're referring to these central bankers essentially, and the people that work for them, what they're trying to do is in the UK is to push reform forward. And I think this whole business about Starmer and the three Ukrainians, obviously, this is just my theory, but I think it is an attempt to gradually lay the foundations to get him out of government or out of number 10. And eventually, swing the nation so far against woke issues and against migration issues. So they're weaponizing those issues, deliberately making people feel like those are the issues that are absolutely top of the agenda, so that someone like Farage or someone of his ilk will be able to walk into number 10. That's what I think they're trying to do.
Yeah, well, maybe creating him as a sort of messiah figure. But, Steve Hall also did say, I asked him, I said, who's in charge? Is it the Prime Minister, the Cabinet, or the King? And he said, none of them. It's the city.
None of them. I would agree. I would agree. Yeah, it's none of them. From what I've been reading and listening to, I would agree that obviously they get bribed with big money, right? And they get bribed with all kinds of things, which is why Tony Blair, it became a multi-millionaire after his premiership. And these things, certain individuals make an absolute mint out of their, being involved in these globalist agendas, and facilitating them and enabling them. They get handsomely rewarded, and they get handsomely protected. So yeah, I don't know what's yeah, I'm trying to nationalize public utilities now in the UK is going to be an uphill battle. And the
Well,
left have
I mean, Starmer already was asked about that, wasn't he? At the 20, I think it was the 2023 Davos. He was quizzed, cross-examined by the World Economic Forum. Are you thinking about privatizing, sorry, nationalizing anything or renationalizing anything? And he said no. He had to say no. I think it was maybe it was Rachel Reeves actually. So they're under heavy manners from this organization.
Well,
And
and Farage has said when he's been asked, would he privatize or introduce a national insurance policy for NHS? And he said, absolutely. So, I think the people who think that reform or these sorts of parties or GB News, for example, people who think that they actually represent the alternative are being deliberately guided, deliberately led in that direction.
well, look, you said earlier on that they're behind on their plan, the
Yeah.
2030 plan, which make brings us on
Well, no, they're
to.
behind on the 2020 plan, and so therefore they're behind on the 2030 as well, yeah.
So this brings up the idea of acceleration, accelerating things, as Elon Musk would say, move fast and break things. So we don't really care about the law anymore. We can always just go to court and pay a fine, as the water
Oh, yeah,
companies are
anyway,
always doing.
the laws are farce now. Anyway, there's no, absolutely.
So how does the whole accelerationist diet? I mean, Ian Davies has written quite a bit about this and the Dark Enlightenment, and my old mate Nazi Nick
Right.
Land. So what do you make of the way that fits in with all of this? Ex trying to accelerate things because it's not going as quick as they want.
I think the purpose with all the chaos, confusion, deliberate muddying the waters, and all the sort of emergency, the type of fear porn that is constantly pumped out. And in fact, I suspect, I mean, I've noticed with these various sort of vehicle ramming incidents, there have been quite a few actually, not just the one that happened in Liverpool last weekend, but it's there's been several where people have been injured or killed in other countries, in Canada, in other countries in Europe. Now, I suspect, again, I mean, this is obviously I don't have any evidence, but I suspect this may be also a sort of Operation Gladio type of thing where they're constantly creating fearful environments. They want people to feel scared all the time, whether it's the fact that, it might be dangerous in a public environment where you're protesting on the street or celebrating a festival or
Yeah, I mean, a joyous occasion
A
suddenly
joyous
turns to a
occasion, yeah,
nightmare.
right.
This is exactly the sort of thing. I mean, since you brought up Liverpool, we can also maybe talk about Southport because the ch same chief constable was in charge of policing that. I mean, there's been no real looking into the mental health record and the history of Radu Kabana, who's apparently behind that, and the way that he wasn't properly contained, even though he's shown many signs of being extremely violent. And there was no effort, it seems, to do anything about that. The same exact thing in the with the Nottingham killer, who was going around stabbing people to death in late at night. These people just allowed to wander the streets. Basically, this seems to be kind of deliberate. But to look at Liverpool, what's happened there? Anyone that's been on, because we were told, weren't we, not to share footage or something. If you look at the footage, you can see exactly what happened. The guy drove his car around the corner behind an ambulance. It didn't appear that he actually knew that there was any big demonstration. Well, it wasn't a demonstration, was it? It was a celebration going on around the corner with loads of people in the streets. So when he realized that, he stopped. The ambulance then carried on slowly, but he stopped and he was just sort of stuck in the middle of the road. After a little while, he then started to gingerly reverse backwards, and the back of the car was then attacked by the thugs who were drinking around him, and he basically panicked and he drove forward. He didn't kill anybody, but the police have now charged him with attempted murder. Now it just seems incredible to me. It's obvious what's happened there. If you look at the footage, you can see what's happened. But what the police are trying to do is to turn it into a major sort of, like this guy did it deliberately, where it seems quite obvious if you look at what's happened that people were trying to get into his car. They ended up also smashing his back window. They were kicking the car. They were attacking the car, and it's those people who were responsible for the incident, not the guy in the car. They panicked him into going forward, and he tried everything he could, and he did. He successfully avoided killing anybody.
Well, the footage that you're referring to, I don't know how widely viewed that is, because I did see the one that you shared of that episode that you're discussing. The footage I've seen shared by other people, it is from on high. It's from like in a building high up above
Yeah,
ground.
that's
So it's
right. That was after the incident where he
that was
started going
after, and that
forward. Yeah.
was. Yeah, and that's so that you don't see the part that you're talking about. So all you see is this car charging into the people. You don't see what started before that. And so which I don't, I suspect the one that you're talking about is probably less well known, I would say, than the one where he, as you say, possibly panicked and went into people.
Well, I mean,
So
if you or I were sitting in
really,
a
who
car and
knows?
people trying to get into the car, people started kicking it, and obviously the car is engines running, you're not going to hang around.
No, right. So yeah, the whole thing is very curious. But as I say, I don't know. I think on the whole, what we're told about events are very, very often very far from what really happened.
Well, the police have basically, it looks to me like the police have just weaponized this as some sort of like terrible nightmare, and the press are saying nothing about the footage that we've seen.
And so this, and I think they like to leave things open for people to speculate in terms of was he what, what nationality was the driver and so on. And they do this repeatedly over and over in order to weaponize this idea that migrants are dangerous and, can't be trusted and weaponize this narrative that, illegal migration is the issue. Whether there is a problem, there may be, as I think even the Workers' Party contends, that if you have massive numbers of legal migration, which is what actually happened under the Tories, is that we had for the last 3 to 5 years, we've had really high numbers of legal migration into the country.
Yeah, it's 750,000 a year.
Easily, yeah. I think in some cases it's been higher. So The fact that the country refuse the government refuses to invest in the national infrastructure, invest in building more affordable housing and making it harder for people to sort of put their houses up, multiple houses on Airbnb and so on. The fact that they don't do may take concrete steps, and they haven't been doing for decades, in investing in affordable housing and investing in, more schools, investing in more hospitals. All they're doing, but they're doing the reverse. They're centralizing instead of decentralizing. And it's the decentralized networks that work best. And again, it's with, like Richard Werner says, in the UK, we have the most centralized banking system in the whole world. We have only a handful of high street banks, and even those are disappearing. And so this is going against the model for economic development, because as Richard Werner often argues in his many videos and talks, is that if you have local banks, lots and lots of local banks, community banks, and so on, anybody who has a business idea, has a idea on how to build a new program in the community or whatever, anybody, people who are entrepreneurs in whatever flavor, if they go to a local bank who knows them, knows where they live, knows their track record, knows their what sort of person they are, they're more likely to lend to them and support their small business. The trouble is now we have all these massive, massive national banks, some of them multinational banks, and they're not, they don't care about the little person, so they're not going to lend for business creation ideas. They're more inclined to lend for asset purchase reasons, like buying a house or a car or so on. But that doesn't add to the economic growth in the community. Buying a house makes no difference to other people's livelihoods and job creation and so on. Whereas starting a business, growing a business would, and their big banks are not interested in lending
No, well, I mean,
to.
what you're describing is the centralization of power in economic hands. And you talked about the Bank for International Settlements, the City of London. I find it just fascinating that they're very similar, these things. So you've got the BIS in Basel, Switzerland, which is a separate jurisdiction to Switzerland. So they have their own police force, etc. And the Swiss police are not allowed past the threshold of the door. We've got a
They have
similar thing
complete
going on with.
diplomatic immunity.
Well, yeah, we've got a similar thing going on with the City of London, which is a completely separate entity. It's got its own police force. The monarch is not allowed in without permission and all this kind of stuff. So, and then you've got one flag, which is the inverse of the other of these two institutions.
Well, the BIS, as I understand it, is the central bank of all central banks.
Well,
So
it's the
it's
place
the top
Mark
bank.
Carney hung out before he came to be governor of the Bank of England. They talk a lot about him being from the Bank of Canada, but actually he was the chairman of the risk committee of the BIS, which regulates the world's central banks. So he's over in this week with King Charles, who's schmoozing with him over in Canada as Charles actually opens the Canadian Parliament. This is a sort of tiny group of elite, and I think you're right when you talk about fascism. There isn't much. If policy has now been ceded to central banks, as it seems it has, and the media is just used as a kind of PR mechanism for that, what we've got is people being driven more and more into debt, so into debt slavery, just as governments have been. And the idea is that when you're making decisions now, you're not basing those decisions on any kind of moral principle, just on finance. So if you make a decision, you're deciding, well, this is going to bring me more money, and so I'm going to do it. You're not interested in the morals anymore.
So in order to fight back, I think basically it's to have at if it's at all possible, the least debt you can possibly have, the better. Downsizing, selling things that you don't need, buying the cheapest or the best value thing that you can. And also, having investing in things in the community, like local community gardens, and sort of various other local projects with your community in order to try and fight back. And also to, I mean, there other people have been talking about this. I'm not so clued up on it, but there's a YouTube channel called Council Watch. There are people who are working within various councils, specifically Colchester, I think, is one which is very active, but also Sandy Adams is very active in her count or in and around her council in Glastonbury. Other people are quite organized, I believe, in Cheltenham and Gloucester area. So there are people who are really getting stuck into their councils and challenging at the local level these global policies, because if you challenge them at the local level, it then they won't it won't work, it because these things, no matter how much they try and deploy it or try to control it from the top, they unless they exercise brute force or some sort of coercive measure, they're not going to get if people resist enough, they won't be able to get the policy off the ground if people refuse to go along with it.
Well, let's hope not. I mean, the only thing I can think of that's happening to organise that sort of thing is the what they call Community Union Acorn here in Bristol. They are very organised around the idea of resisting eviction, for example. So anyone that's having some sort of unfair eviction of whatever sort, say for example, if they're ill and the courts have just awarded a possession order to whatever it is, a landlord or a bank. Against them, then they will lobby on their behalf and then they'll turn up and stand in the way of the bailiffs.
Yeah, well, funnily enough, I've been on the other side of that. And what happened was I actually, because I absolutely had to sell it to pay off the mortgage, and they refused to move. She refused to move. So I didn't want to go to battle and evict her. So what I did was I put it on the market, sold it with tenant in situ. But unfortunately, the estate agent said, well, in order to sell it with a tenant in situ, you lose 20,000 of market value. So we
That's
sold
right,
it
yeah.
at, yeah. So, but I mean, I chose to do that instead of, go to court and try and kick her out.
Wow. Well, I mean, yeah, so it would be nice if we could just completely do away with eviction, because it seems this is one of the main, almost a sort of subconscious level in which people are hit. You know, like you're going to do you put all your time and investment into a little place where you are, it's rented or a mortgage, or if you get into debt and you have to remortgage the place, suddenly your home is uprooted. I mean, it seems to me to be a basic human right. People should be able to have at least somewhere that they can stay. But anyway, look.
Well, the reason we have that problem is because the government hasn't invested in, council housing and affordable housing.
On
Right,
purpose. Yeah. Anyway.
precisely, yeah.
Anyway, look, Catherine, I wonder if you could just let people know whereabouts they can find and follow you online. Thank you for your advice about what we can do. I think this is always crucial. Many of us know there's problems. We are suffering with angst. We're starting to understand where that angst is coming from. You know, anxiousness about our circumstances and situation, and that's completely normal. I wonder if you could just let people know where they can find and follow you.
Well, basically, I'm on Facebook, I'm on Telegram, and that's it, really.